Du bist auf Osteopathie-Visite mit Klaas und Dennis. Und dieser Podcast heißt Knochenjob.
Thank you for being here. The first question is, how did you come along dry needling?
I started with dry needling. In 1989, I went to a workshop taught by Janet Travell, who was Kennedy's White House doctor once upon a time in the 60s, and Johnson's White House doctor too, actually, after Kennedy was assassinated. And I worked in the hospital at the time, and she was in the hospital right next door, so I went to her workshop. She was 89 years old, 88 years old, I think, 88 years old, yeah. And I was quite intrigued by that. I contacted her afterwards and said, how can I learn more? And that started the friendship and a mentorship. And she did not really do dry needling herself. She mentioned a few times that she really did not. She used syringes to use dry needling every now and then, but that was really not what we currently would call dry needling. And so I became more interested in it. Like, there should be a way to do this better. Years later, in 93, 94, I contacted the physical therapy board in Maryland, the state where I live and work in the States. I said, can I do dry needling? And to my surprise, they said yes.
No like, problem.
Really? Okay. So I went to a physician I worked with, who was also a colleague of Janet Travell. His name is Bob Gervin. And he said, well, I don't really do dry needling, but probably not that different from doing injections, but we don't really know. So I spent some time with him to see what he does, and then I started just kind of playing with it and did it in my clinic. Today you couldn't get away with that. That would be irresponsible, people would say. But I did it, and it was kind of like, well, this seems to work. So a few months later, I called the board again because, like, I have nothing in writing. I just have someone telling me I could do that. So I called them again. It's still America, so people sue each other every now and then. Yeah. Although that really doesn't happen as much as people think. But so now I was reaffirmed. Hey, I already told you can do this. Not a problem. The board approved that a long time ago, back in 1984. As a matter of fact, I learned later.
Just in Maryland back then, or
that was in Maryland. Yeah. Maryland was the first state to approve dry needling in the States in 1984. Yeah. Currently, there are 35 states and the District of Columbia that have formally approved dry needling by physical therapists, and there's still a few states where there's no opinion, and there's a few states where it's actually illegal. But in Maryland was the first in 1984. It was another physical therapist who had requested that, and he got it in writing that it was okay. And that's still the case. So at one point in 95 or 6, I'm not totally sure, I found courses in Canada in intramuscular stimulation by Chen Gunn. I was like, that looks like dry needling, a form of dry needling. Said I should probably get some formal education because I really didn't have any. Stuck needles in people without ever being really formally trained in it. So I went to Canada. But before I could go there, they told me I needed a letter from the Board of Physical Therapy of Maryland that I could legally do this. So I contacted them again and said, could you send me a note? Then I was told, no, you have to do that through the board. It needs to be formal. I'm not allowed to write notes like that, letters like that. So I requested to the board. And to my surprise, I got a call back or a letter back. What is dry needling? We've never heard of that. I'm like, that's strange because I've been told twice that it's legal and the board doesn't know what it is. The boards, of course, change every so many months or years. There's different volunteers who do this. And I've learned early on in this whole process of dry needling that boards often lack institutional memory, as I like to call it. So the boards, the only reason that I was told that it was okay was the administrator had been there forever and she remembered that it was approved. And somewhere in her files was probably a piece of paper that said that, but none of the current board members had ever had anything to do with dry needling, so they had no idea what it was. It was an interesting lesson to learn that. But long story short, they did give me that letter eventually. That took a while. I went to Canada. I took the courses from Chen Gunn, and I got certified by his approach. By then, I'd already met a few other people in the world who were in the same situation I was in. There was someone in Switzerland, Christian Gröbli, and there was in Spain for Orlando Mayoral in Toledo. We were kind of in the same position that we all wanted to do dry needling for physios. And we're all kind of like, well, how can we really do that? In Switzerland, it was technically illegal. Because there it goes by cantons, and it was really technically illegal. In Spain, it was technically illegal. So Maryland was really the only place where, of the three of us, where I legally could do this. So we got together at one point, I think it was 97, in Spain, to kind of practice on each other, like, how would you do this? If you have a quadratus lumborum, what's the anatomy like? Can you actually do this? And we shared ideas that we all had developed, and slowly but steadily we kind of came to a consensus what you could do and what you shouldn't do. And that's still being promoted, I think. We're still changing it a little bit, but most of the muscles we're pretty comfortable with that we can hurt and need them the best. But there's not all of them have been quantified yet.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you've been trained by Janet Travell.
Not in dry needling, really, but more in the concepts of myofascial pain.
Yeah. She's one of the pioneers in myofascial pain. Yeah.
Correct.
Have you any anecdotes from back then, learning from her, from the pioneer, or nice anecdotes, funny stories? I don't know.
Yeah, I know lots of funny stories. I'm not sure I want to share those in an interview.
Yeah, I hope so.
Well, she was a very smart lady, very sure she was right.
Okay.
Didn't really tolerate many opinions that were different than hers, let's put it that way.
Okay.
But also very intelligent. I'll tell you one story. The last time she lectured in public, she was, I believe, 94 years old.
Oh.
And she had an hour lecture time. So after about 10 minutes before the hour, a little light showed up on the lectern. Like, okay, you need to wrap it up. And then 5 minutes later, there's a red light. Now you really need to stop. She ignored those entirely and just kept talking. Her slides, she actually used still real slides in those days, that no one uses anymore, of course, but those are real slides that were dated to 1937 and 1948. They actually had the date at the bottom. I'm like, wow, those are old slides. So the organizer, Bob Gerwin, tried to get her attention. She's like, you need to really stop. And I'm sure she saw that and totally ignored him. So after a few minutes, 10 after, 15 after the hour, so she was already way over
time.
1 hour
over time.
He went on the stage and whispered in her ear that she really needed to stop now because the next speaker was waiting. And she waited for him to sit back down and then looked down at from the lectern on the podium. She said, Bob, you know, I am 95 years old, and how many opportunities do you think these lovely people will have to listen to me in the future? And she got a standing ovation when she said that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but that really happened. And right. So Bob Gerwin was never seen again after that. No, he shriveled away in his chair. And he was like, okay, maybe shouldn't have said anything. And she talked for an hour and 40 minutes. And the next speaker was fine with that. They're like, well, what am I going to say? It's fine. So, yeah, she was quite determined that she was right. So was David Simons. I worked actually more with David Simons than with Travell. David Simons was a lot more stubborn and a little bit impatient with people. So I started writing a literature review column with him, which I did for 10 years with him. When he finally stopped. I still write that literature review column today, so I've been doing this for...
Yes, in the Journal of Bodywork and Movement.
That's where it is now. It used to be in the Journal of Musculoskeletal Pain, and Musculoskeletal Pain, but that journal is no longer existing. And the Journal of Bodywork and Movement Therapy has much better exposure, so it's actually a much better journal to do that for. So, in retrospect, I actually regret that I did it for the Journal of Musculoskeletal Pain so long, because it doesn't exist anymore. And it was never listed in PubMed, so people couldn't really find that either.
Okay.
So if it's not in PubMed, it's why would you write for it? It's kind of a waste of time, to be honest. But that's the journal that David Simons wrote in, so I kind of joined him, and that's where it was. Mm-hmm. And when that journal became less and less valid, I switched over to the journal Body Work and Movement Therapies. And that's been my, the exposure has been much greater.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty consistently the one of the top downloaded articles of that journal. So okay, there's great. Definitely a demand for, I think, definitely an interest for, let's put it that way, that's probably a better word.
Okay.
So this is my anecdotal story for Travel.
Yeah.
But I have lots of others, but I'm not going to interview.
Okay. No problem. I like it. Okay. So it's not really trackable. Who was the first one who used a dry needling approach instead of injections? Or I think I've heard that Kara Lewitt from Czech Republic was the first one. You told me about a gun.
That was at the same time, really. It started, the whole dry needling terminology, as far as I know, the first time it was mentioned was in 1947 in an article in The Lancet.
Okay.
That's the first time that I know of that the term dry needling was definitively used. Mm. In 1944, Steinbrucker, who's an orthopedic surgeon, published already, and he did communicate to Travell about that he thought it was not the procaine that Travell used, but the needle that actually had the therapeutic effect. Travell used procaine. And then the many decades, nothing really happened. And it was in 1979 that Karl Lewitt from Prague published a paper in Pain about... he needled lots of different structures, not just trigger point. He needled periosteum, ligaments, tendons, bellies, muscle bellies. Anything you could put a needle in, he needled practically. And that combined, he found that about 87% of sites had significantly less pain, which he called a needle effect.
Okay.
So that was in 1979. Chen Gun had already published papers before that about his approach. And then he's published his first study in 1980. So they were really contemporary. They were really at the same time. So both were the earlier people who did dry needling. It didn't really become much popular after that. Chen Gun definitely became very popular in Canada. And it's still today, I think, the predominant form of dry needling in Canada is probably IMS. There are other companies now teaching more dry needling, more in line with what I think dry needling should be. In Canada, I've done a few courses myself there. I'm working on expanding that in Canada, but it's not entirely up to me. That's one of the factors that I have to patiently wait to evolve. Let's put it that way.
Okay. I would like to continue with some specific questions on the technique.
Yeah.
Is the local twitch response, is it necessary to get the best results? What's your opinion? What does the evidence say? I'm sure you're familiar with the evidence about it.
Yeah. I like that you qualify that statement and not just say, is a local twitch response necessary? Because for needling, the twitch response, I don't think is necessary, but to get the best results, I think it is necessary. So there's a distinction there. It's debatable, though, because the research does exist, but it's experimental research. There is very little clinical research that supports the local twitch response. There are actually a few papers that say it didn't make any difference. There are also a few recent papers that say that it did make a difference. So that's a little bit, and again, in my talk this afternoon, I have a slide. There's literature that shows that dry needling works, and there's literature that shows that it doesn't work, like with everything else. Why am I in favor of the twitch response? If you treat trigger points, that is, there's other applications of dry needling as well. But for trigger points, it is known that trigger points are associated with a greater than normal end plate noise. That degree of end plate noise is correlated with level of pain. If you get the twitch response, the irritability of the end plate and the levels of pain decrease at the same time in clinic. There's a recent paper that actually shows that that needling with a twitch response decreases the amount of see the acetylcholine release from the motor end plate, increases the release of acetylcholine esterase, and decreases the formation of acetylcholine receptors. That's in a mouse, so in a rodent, so it's not in humans. But that's still a good indication that something actually happens at the motor end plate. The research at NIH and also in Taiwan showed that the Twitch response facilitated a reduction of all the chemicals, pro-inflammatory mediators at the trigger site of the trigger point immediately decreased after the Twitch. But non-Twitch needling, if there's such a thing, you don't really know what the results are. There's no one has ever studied putting a needle in place and leaving it there, or turning it or doing whatever you want. But now the Twitch response, do you still get a release of the concentration of the diminishing of the concentration of these chemicals? No one's ever done that. It clearly does something. So in the clinic, you don't always get Twitch responses. Some muscles, it would be pure luck. The latrotheracoid, for example, is one such muscle. You can't palpate that muscle, so all you can do is put a needle in and hope for the best. And yet it has dramatic results, and you don't always get Twitch responses. The psoas is another one. You can palpate the psoas through the abdomen, but you can't needle through the abdomen, so you have to needle either from the side or from posterior, and you can never really match up your palpation findings with the direction of the needle, because how would you know where that was in relation to the way you put a needle? So that needling becomes very aspecific, and yet it works. So patients don't necessarily get that Twitch response because you're not directly at that trigger point. If you are, you should play a lot of the lottery because you're very lucky. And yet it works fine. So that's an argument against emphasizing a Twitch response. But I think the experimental data still suggests that a Twitch response makes sense. So to get the best results, I do advocate still to use a Twitch response. Is it necessary to get results? No, it's not. I think to get the best results, I still advocate that I think there's enough evidence to show that that's useful.
Yeah. Okay. You also mentioned rotating the needle. What's your opinion about rotating the needle?
Well, I'd like to again look at what research tells us. And there's research initially all from Helene Langevin, who's now at Harvard. She did not look at trigger points. She looked at acupuncture and tried to come up with reasons why acupuncture may work. What she clearly showed is when you rotate the needle that the fibers can catch the needle and coil around the needle, stretching basically the local tissue. She emphasized stretching fibroblasts, and when you put mechanical stress on a fibroblast, fibroblasts regulate a lot of functions in the fascia and in muscles, including release of cytokines and other things like that. If you stretch a fibroblast, you actually get a reduction in pain. You get neuromodulation. I think the story is a little bit more complicated than that. So if you rotate the needle, I'm sure you get a local stretch if the needle is not too slippery. We now use needles for the regular pistoning type of dry needling style. And those needles are too slippery. You can turn them as much as you want. They never catch the tissue because they're polished too many times.
Yeah. So polished and also covered with silicone?
No, there's no silicone on this. No, there's no silicone. People say that, but that's really not the case. There's no silicone there.
Okay.
Those are Spanish needles that I use in our clinic and our courses. They have no silicone layer. They're just super, super slippery. So for techniques where you want to catch the tissue, we actually had to make needles that are not as slippery, though they're only polished once instead of three times. Mm-hmm. And those surfaces are still rough enough that it catches the needle and stretches them. So that technique is a lot more painful. That hurts a lot more for patients, for most people. It's because you really get a local stretch. But it's very useful for certain applications. And one thing that we started to do a lot more is actually dry needling for scar tissue. And for scar tissue, I don't know any other technique that is as effective in getting rid of painful scars.
Okay.
I don't know if I'll demonstrate this afternoon. I do a workshop. I have not really planned what I'm going to do for the workshop. I'd like to know what people want to do.
I would love to hear about that.
Yeah.
That's a wonderful thing. Okay. Yeah, thank you. And what is the best combination after or before doing dry needling in a clinic setting? beyond spray and stretch. I think this is...
Well, spray and stretch, I think, is an outdated modality. I don't... I really never use spray and stretch. I have not used it for many years. Partially because it can't be healthy to spray fluoromethane in a closed room all day and inhaling that all day as a therapist. So that was my first objection. And in 1990, I think, Travell and Simons actually wrote a letter to the editor of the Archives of Physical Medicine to stop using the spray.
Okay.
Because of environmental impact. Mm-hmm. When the people who developed it say stop doing it, I think we should listen. Interesting also, this just 2 weeks ago, a new edition of the Travell and Simons textbook was published. The third edition, Spray and Stretch, is not even mentioned in the book. It's totally gone. So I'm sure that will make some traditional therapy people quite upset, because that's what they do all day. I am also concerned about fluoromethane, and now it's a different product, and I'm aware that it changed, the product changed. The fluoromethane is banned in most countries except America, because America did not sign the Kyoto Agreement, and every other smart country did. So you can't even manufacture it anymore, you can't even sell it anymore for the clinical use. The new product, in my opinion, is not much better. It's an ozone, it's a greenhouse gas still. It's not, it just means it does not go that high up in the atmosphere, but it's still a greenhouse gas, so why would we use that? So I have not used spray and stretch in probably, I don't even know, 20-some years, probably more than that. So spray and stretch to me is not really something you should consider. That is, I'm sure it's effective as a counter-irritant, but there are much better things to do. So I'm also not a big fan of heat and cold after dry needling. Although there are papers that show that it is effective, especially cold, effective in reducing post-needling soreness. So that's an argument. But I am frankly questioning why we would be so concerned about post-needling soreness. That's easy for me to say because I'm the clinician. I don't have the post-needling soreness. I understand that. But at the same time, I think there's actually value to having some discomfort after needling. Needling basically causes a little bit of tissue damage. Yeah, because you puncture someone with a needle. So there's muscle damage, there's fascia damage, skin damage. You go through all these structures, you create a hole, and you poke around, and you create some damage. That damage is probably not that different from damage you get when you work out lifting weights. And I've never heard someone say 2 days later, oh my gosh, my pecs are so painful, I need to do something about it. People say, like, quite the opposite. Soreness after exercise is usually seen as a positive. And the reinforcement, oh my gosh, I really need to go back to the gym. I need to work out. So why would similar pain after dry needling be such a bad thing? So I honestly don't believe it is that terrible. I think it's actually a sign that maybe you need to slow down a little bit while you're healing. So suppressing that with ibuprofen or what's it called in the instant? What do you call that medication? Paracetamol? It's not that useful. It's probably okay to have a little bit of an inflammatory response, but that is what the body does. So why would you suppress that? I'm also not sure that you need to put ice on it or heat on it or do stretches after it. I never stretch people after needling, which is the common knowledge that you need to stretch everyone. I'm actually not sure what the new textbook says about stretching. I have not read that part. I only wrote 2 chapters for that book, but more the scientific background chapters than anything else. The first chapter I was co-author on of the new textbook of Travell and Simons. But I had nothing to do with the clinical chapter, so I don't really know honestly what they recommend if you still stretch. I don't stretch patients in my clinic. I have not found it to make any difference. And back to the pain, post-needling soreness, I have actually worked with a therapist in Iran. She has a doctorate in physical therapy now. And she did the study that she and I designed together. It was my idea to look at, does it really make a difference in patients' perception based on what the therapist tells that patient. And so we had 3 groups in the study. The study has not been submitted yet, but we'll hope to finish it soon. It's written up, it's on my desk, I have to review it, and I haven't had time to do that yet. We had 3 groups of 25 patients per group. The study was done in Tehran, in Iran. And the first group was told, dry needling is just like working out. You'll be sore. That's a great sign. Wonderful. Excellent. Don't worry about it. Almost enjoy it. It's the best thing you can do. The second group got the opposite message. So dry needling is great, but one thing is really kind of sad. It really, really hurts afterwards. And we want you to keep a pain diary to keep track of how much it really hurts. So really emphasizing the pain. The third group, also 25 patients, was told nothing. So that was kind of the control in this. And I honestly expected that the first group would not be complaining too much about post-needling soreness. I figured that the second group would be complaining a lot because they were so hypervigilant about recording pain levels, and the third group was probably somewhere in the middle. That's what I had anticipated. Well, the study was done. I was in Iran last year, and this year as well, actually, but last year the study was finished. And I was still in process, but the researcher, the physio who did the study, said, like, oh my gosh, it's failing. And like, why is that? He said, because there's no difference in between the groups.
Really?
And like, well, that doesn't mean it's failing. But he was advised to come up with more subjects, to add subjects to the pool. But when we looked at the data, they were all flat. There was no upwards trend in one group that with more subjects you would actually get a statistically significant difference. So I honestly did not believe that adding subjects would help because they were all the same. There was no difference at all. And so we concluded that post-needling soreness for patients really is not that big a deal. And therapists make a big deal of it, but I think we should stop doing that, to be honest. We should just tell people, yes, there's a little bit of tissue injury. You're healing 3 to 7 days. It's probably totally healed based on the rat model, the alpha mouse model, again, as well. Don't worry about it. It's fine. Because what the study in Iran showed, and again, it has not been published yet, but we'll hope to do that soon, it showed that patients were so happy with the clinical results that they no longer had migraine headaches, that they no longer had low back pain, that they no longer had pain in the knee or the buttocks or whatever the pain was. The pain was not, the location didn't matter in this study. That the post-needling soreness was surprised that everyone was happy to pay. It did not matter. People really didn't care. Now, that could be typical for people in Iran. That may not be universal. But I seriously doubt that. In my clinic, I never focus on post-needling soreness. And yes, some people mention it. It's like, oh my gosh, I'm so sore. And then you can talk about it. But I'm more inclined to say, yes, it will be a little sore for a while. It could be now. It could be 2 days. It varies a lot. Don't worry about it. That's normal. And I honestly, that's anecdotal, of course. I have not seen that most, that many people freak out about that. It's really not that big a problem. So I'm not sure that it matters whether having pain or not.
Okay. And can you maybe share about your own experiences in your own clinical practice about more severe side effects? Have you had any, or would you like to communicate them? Because I think...
I'm happy to talk about that. I honestly think that people sometimes underestimate what could happen. Mm-hmm. In my clinic, I've never had a significant adverse event in the clinic other than soreness and very minor bruising every now and then, but that's about it. But there's definitely an increase in injuries worldwide, I think.
Okay.
Caused by physical therapists, and that's mostly because dry needling becomes much more popular all of a sudden. So there are many, many people are teaching it, many people are taking the courses, many people are doing it in the clinic. I'm not convinced that all course programs spend enough time on safety, but I have to be careful saying that because that can be easily interpreted that I'm upset about competitors, which I'm absolutely not. I don't care that there are competitors. I think that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. So it's not a statement of spite, like, oh my gosh, I wish. Because for the first 10 years in America, we were the only ones teaching dry needling courses in the whole country. No one else did that. So I started dry needling courses in the U.S. And after about 10 years, one of our former students started his own program and now did 27 different programs in the U.S. to teach dry needling. So there's a lot of competition in that sense. But it's also a very big country, so it doesn't really matter. I mean, it's irrelevant. 100 million people in America have chronic pain, a third of the population. So why would we worry about competitors? It doesn't make any sense. You just have to be, if you do it, I think you just have to be the best you can be. But back to the side effects, the pneumothorax is usually quoted as the most significant side effect, a bad significant adverse event. And in fact, pneumothorax really isn't all that horrible. It's horrible if you get it. I understand that. But pneumothorax from dry needling usually heals. It usually does not require treatment. It's a small part of the of one lobe may be collapsed, and mostly not the whole lung. It's usually 15-20% of a lung collapses, and that's usually heals spontaneously. Of course, you should avoid it. I think a much more significant adverse event is subdural hematomas. Okay. And there have been, in the literature, only 6 cases described in the world literature that I'm aware of. But at the same time, I have seen several cases in the U.S. where people had this in the capacity of an expert witness in legal lawsuits. One was a consultant. I was a consultant to a case that happened that I don't think it went to court. But there's other cases also that did go to court. Some pneumothoraces as well. But the subdural hematomas are very, very serious because what they do when people needle along the spine, maybe needling, trying to needle multifidi muscles or something, if the needle direction is not correct, you can actually hit the dura. And in several patients, not a lot of patients, of course, but it has led to very dramatic results. And the results are usually paralysis and loss of bladder function. Yeah. So you have a neurogenic bladder and you can't walk from dry needling. And that's pretty serious. And these cases have been described in the cervical spine, thoracic, and lumbar spine. Mm-hmm. In the lumbar spine, I know of one incident where someone was paralyzed from T9 down and had loss of bladder control. Mm-hmm. And that's, of course, a very serious side effect of doing dry needling, which is much more severe than a pneumothorax, which a week later you can't see anymore. It disappears. And these cases of paralysis are based in subdural hematomas. The challenge is what to do with them once it happens because they're paralyzed and they can't move anymore. So the surgical solution is to do multi-level laminectomies to get rid of the bleeding of the hematomas, which is not great, of course, because that's also a significant problem. One case that I'm referring to from T9 on did not get surgery, and most of it did resolve at the time when I was consulted on it. Yeah. She still had bladder issues, but she could walk again, because once the hematoma dissolves, if it's in a certain timeline, everything should be fine. But if it takes too long, you could have permanent nerve damage. So then the question is, does your gait ever come back, or are you going to be paralyzed the rest of your life? So to me, that's a much more significant side effect. Having said that, we did a study in Ireland that showed that the risk of a significant adverse event was less than 0.04%. But that assumes being trained properly. Mm-hmm. And the problem with that is that everyone quotes that study. It's Brady et al. It's actually very funny. Even another anecdote, I testified recently in Florida, but a Florida physical therapist should get the right to do dry needling because it's a whole bunch of legal challenges. Strange state in a sense. Court case for an administrative judge. And during the deposition, which was a few days earlier, the expert acupuncturist arguing against dry needling for a physical therapist tried to prove to me and to the court that physical therapists are very dangerous compared to acupuncturists. So we had an acupuncture study actually here from Germany by Witte, a large study of acupuncture that said that the adverse event rate was 8.3% or so, 8.6%, I forget exactly. And physical therapists of 19.3% by a study by Brady et al. And I was asked whether I was familiar with that study, and I was like, well, it sounds like you did not really read the study other than the abstract, because I am one of the et al. And, 19.3% seemed like a very high percentage of adverse events. But the critical number in that study was the risk of a significant adverse event was less than 0.04%. So adverse events in that study were defined based on the European guidelines for adverse events, where it's basically said that any outcome that's not the intended therapeutic outcome is an adverse event. So if you stick a needle in the skin and people say, ow, that's an adverse event.
Okay.
if you take a needle out and there's a drop of blood on the skin, it's an adverse event.
Okay.
If 2 days later the patient comes back to have a little bruise on their arm, it's an adverse event. So the first four more common adverse events were those hematoma, bleeding, pain during and after needling, so four. If you take those away, which actually one of the reviewers of that paper suggested, said, why do you call that an adverse event? Isn't that normal? And you can argue that that's normal. In the German study, those were not considered adverse events.
Not at all.
Not at all. And the German study was retroactive on a chart review of the national medical records. Ours was prospective, so we could define it any way we want. We followed the UN guidelines. The German study did not even define adverse event. What do you really mean by that? It's not in the paper. So if you take those four away, that was good for 17.5% of the adverse events. So you had 1.8 left by physical therapy, which is a very good profile. So it was kind of funny that people tried to take that paper out of context and quote it in the court room. And then the actual court case itself, it was repeated and they had to refute it again. Because that makes no sense. The fact is that I needed my physical therapists who are well trained, and I use that qualifier now, it's extremely safe. But it does not matter that things can happen. Things do happen in physical therapy and in acupuncture. So you have to always be very vigilant about knowing anatomy. If you're not sure, if you have an obese patient where you can't really develop or to appreciate the anatomy, you shouldn't do anything. And in our courses, I use the line, when in doubt, stay out. If you're not 150% sure, you shouldn't do it. And as long as you follow that principle, again, I have never had a significant adverse event in my clinic, and I've done this for 20-some years now. So, and I think that's fairly consistent with what other people have done. So the adverse events are very rare. The serious ones are very rare, but they're probably on the increase just because of sheer volume of people who use dry needling. So I do think dry needling is very safe. I don't have any regrets. There are two studies 2 years ago, 2016. One was in the Netherlands, the other one's in the US, that were kind of typical. The Netherlands study was the first time in a Dutch medical journal that dry needling was actually mentioned. So it was not really good promotion of dry needling because it was a fairly significant case where a patient who had a total hip replacement came to the physical therapist, I believe 7 months after the surgery, with pain in his hip. The therapist did an evaluation and concluded that, oh, your muscle's a little tight, I can do some dry needling, no problem. Did one session of dry needling. The patient already had an appointment with the orthopedic surgeon who had done the surgery 7 months earlier. So the surgeon said, oh, that's very strange. Why would that hurt so much? So the surgeon did blood work, and found that the patient had a staphylococcus infection. And then the doctor published a paper in the Dutch medical journal stating that the physical therapist had caused a staphylococcus infection. And we contacted, or a colleague of mine in the Netherlans contacted this physician. We planned to write a letter to the editor, which unfortunately did not happen, but we did have intention to do that. And we asked some questions. What kind of dry needling was done? What size needle was used? And the physician did not know the answer to any of these questions because he never talked to the physio. So if you use a 3-centimeter needle, there's no way you can even come close to the joint, the hip joint in this case. The doctor had no idea. Then the colleague in the Netherlands also looked to the microbiologist and said, what do you think of that? And the microbiologist was 100% sure that you cannot get those kind of infections from dry needling, those infections from the surgery.
All right, 7 months after.
The case in the States was almost the same, but this involved a 15-year-old patient who had a scoliosis correction at age 12, so 3.5 years earlier, so much longer than 7 months, 3.5 years earlier. And same scenario, she had intrascapular pain. The physical therapist in the States said, oh, I can do some dry needling, that should help. One session, same story, went to the doctor, lab work, another infection in the hardware in the spine. She had scoliosis correction at every single level, and paper was published, and the physical therapist was guilty, declared guilty.
Same, in court.
No, not in court, just in the paper. Just in the paper. I don't think it went to court. Not that I know of, anyway. May have, but I don't know. I think I would have heard about that. And again, the doctor had never checked with the physical therapist, like, what actually happened? What did you do? What kind of needles did you use? And again, the bacteria that were found in the lab study, you cannot get from dry needling. So these are two published papers that were published almost in the same month, blaming physical therapists for infections, where in fact, every orthopedic surgeon should know that you can still get surgical infections up to 5 years after surgery. So that's hard to find that literature. We found a few references in the orthopedic literature. We really searched for, like, do surgeons actually publish that ever? Or do they not publish that? They're quite reluctant to publish that, I think. But the take-home lessons for anyone who does dry needling, if you have a patient who has all of a sudden unexplained pain in a region of a prosthesis or your hardware in general, whether it's spine or whether it's joint, I would probably recommend not to do dry needling. Send the patient back to the surgeon if you're within that five-year window and say, like, look, it's probably nothing, but it's so close to the surgery site, I'm afraid you may have an infection. Before you stick a needle in a patient, because you're probably going to be blamed. And there's another paper in a medical journal telling the whole world that the physical therapist was wrong. So I think you have to protect your profession. And if you have these cases, these people have pain. They can have pain for another week. That's fine. That sounds harsh, but I really don't mean it that way. Because if the surgeon does the work, they probably order lab work anyway. Why would you put yourself in between that? That makes no sense. Although I'm convinced that you cannot cause an infection with a needle. That has never happened, has never been described in the literature other than in these two flawed papers.
So. Okay. Nice final words. Anything to add? Where can people learn about your seminars?
About my seminars, easy is to go to our website. It's called myopinseminars.com. That website will change very, very soon, probably in the next week or so. We have actually totally new website developed, but we haven't launched it yet. There's still a few little problems with it, but everything's described there.
Okay. So, thanks for the interview, for your time.
Okay, very good.
Der Knochenjob-Podcast wird gesponsert von der Praxissoftware Lemniscus. Ich bin seit Jahren zufriedener Kunde. Das liegt unter anderem daran, dass mir Lemniscus sehr viel Zeit und auch einiges an Geld eingespart hat. Ich nutze vor allen Dingen die Kalenderfunktion. Dadurch ist es sehr einfach, die Patienten einzuplanen, in verschiedene Spalten einzutragen oder dass diese sich ganz einfach online bei euch einen Termin buchen können und selber die Zeit und den Therapeuten auswählen können. Mit wenigen Klicks ist die Rechnung erstellt und an eure Patienten per E-Mail versendet. Dadurch kommt man dem Traum von einer papierlosen Praxis deutlich näher. Ihr benötigt kein Papier, um die Rechnung auszudrucken oder um diese per Post zu verschicken und spart dabei auch noch Porto. Ebenso könnt ihr unterschiedliche Bezahlungsmodalitäten wählen, egal ob per Rechnung, EC-Karte oder auch bar. Eine Funktion, die ich auch sehr, sehr zu schätzen weiß, ist die automatische Terminerinnerung. Ihr könnt einstellen, wie viele Tage vorher eure Patientinnen und Patienten an den Termin bei euch in der Praxis erinnert werden sollen. Dadurch kam es bei mir zu deutlich weniger Ausfallterminen und zu einer höheren Zufriedenheit bei meinen Patientinnen und Patienten. Falls ihr noch andere Praxis-Software-Lösungen nutzt, ist es auch relativ einfach, die dort vorhandenen Daten bei Lemniscus einzuspielen, so dass es ein ziemlich einfacher Wechsel ist. Lemniscus bietet Praxislösungen an für Solo-Selbstständige. Also wenn ihr nur wenige Patienten im Monat habt, dann ist das für euch auch möglich und bereits ab 15 Euro pro Monat erhältlich. Habt ihr eine größere Praxis mit mehreren Mitarbeitern, ist auch das kein Problem. Da könnt ihr ein größeres Paket dazu buchen. Der Knochenjob-Podcast hat durch die Kooperation mit Lemniscus die Möglichkeit, dass ihr davon profitiert und einen Rabatt von 20% auf das erste Jahr bekommt. Der Gutscheincode, den ihr dafür angeben müsst bei der Buchung, ist Knochenjob. Mit dem Gutscheincode Knochenjob bekommt ihr 20% auf das erste Jahr bei der Praxis Software Lemniscus. Lemniscus mit C.